I'm excited to dig into Daniel chapter 3 with you. I've been preparing all week and wrestling with it. It's one of those, Daniel chapter 3 is one of those chapters that you kind of hear as kids. Your mom or dad may read it to you. You hear it in Sunday school. Or you may hear it at a youth camp where the speaker is beckoning the youth to stand for Christ. We'll see some of that today, but I want to encourage you as we go into Daniel chapter 3 to kind of come objective as you can to Daniel chapter 3 and really ask the question, what's the main idea? What's really happening? What's the main proposition? What is the main idea in this chapter? In Scripture, one of the main attributes of God is His holiness. He is holy, which means that He's completely separate from His creation in His purity and righteousness. He is complete or whole in and of Himself. His holiness points out that there is no other God like our God. Well, today's passage in Daniel chapter 3 underscores His holiness. Like Daniel chapter 1 and Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 3 can kind of, it's like an episode on a show, like Monk. You know, you have a story that, like, every week it's a new story from beginning to end, but it kind of ties in with the rest of the story. Like, there's little nuggets throughout the episode that go, oh, I've heard that theme or that story before, and it kind of ties in, and in the end of all the seasons of Monk, it's a beautifully well-written end, I might add. All the ends are kind of tied together. Well, Daniel chapter 3 functions as its own little story, but it ties to the main story. Nebuchadnezzar and his servants are contrasted, just like in Daniel chapter 1 and Daniel chapter 2, with the servants of the God of Israel. And then that contrast, once again, serves as the framework for our time together tonight. We'll see two contrasting groups of people, the untrusting Nebuchadnezzar and his tattling Chaldeans and the henchmen, and the faithful servants of Yahweh, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then the last thing we'll see is the faithfulness of our holy God. So follow along with me as we read this chunk of Scripture. Daniel chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it upon the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. The king Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. I'm going to pause here. I want you to be listening as we read through this. Listen for redundancy, repetition, anything that's said over and over and over and over and over, because it'll tie to the main purpose. All right, back to the passage, verse 3. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image." And then whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you, nor do they serve the gods or serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall be immediately cast into the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he'll deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid to ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Man, there's a lot in that chapter. It's a fun chapter. It's dramatic. Like I said, I can remember listening to several sermons in youth camps about this passage. The sermon always emphasized courage and strength to stand up against a tyrannical Nebuchadnezzar who was like wicked friends who smoked pot, got tattoos, and listened to rap music. How many of you remember a sermon like that? Maybe it's just me. I grew up in those circles. But although it's a theme in this chapter, the courage to stand is not the main theme of chapter 3. The main idea of this passage is there is no one who can save like our God can save. There is no one who can save like our God can save. I prepared for this. If we take it back, a step back and look at the narrative structure of chapter 3, the first 8 verses kind of serve as like the plot development to lay the groundwork that every nation in the world is being called, beckoned to worship a pagan idol set up, did you catch that repeated phrase? Set up by King Nebuchadnezzar. The plot thickens as the king's wise men, the Chaldeans, turn into tattletalers against the 3 unfaithful young men. In response, the king threatens to destroy the 3 young men. And his question in verse 15 serves as the primary question of the entire chapter. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hand? That question is answered by the 3 faithful men in verses 16 through 18, by God in verses 19 through 25 in his actions, and by Nebuchadnezzar himself in verses 26 through 30. And that serves as the framework of our sermon. The misplaced trust of Nebuchadnezzar, the resolute faith of God's men, the spectacular deliverance of the Most High God. The repetition and rhythm, did you kind of feel it in the chapter as we read about? The repetition and rhythm of this chapter gives the chapter a feel of a song or a poem, actually. In ancient poetry, the way that in America, what we do is when we have a poem, we'll rhyme it with like the end nouns or end sounds of a word. Well, the way that poetry in this time worked is it rhymed thoughts and ideas. You can find those thoughts and ideas all throughout the chapter. The leadership of the nations is repeated. The music is repeated. The image is repeated. Repetition is all over the chapter. And if you count them, you'll find that the names of the 3 faithful men are repeated 12 times in the chapter. And there's a reason. Remember the meaning of the names? I mean, Shadrach means the command of a coup, or the moon god. Meshach means who is like a coup. Again, the moon god. Abednego means servant of Nabu, or the god of art and writing and vegetation. The mention of their names is intended to kind of be like comic relief to the original reader. Why? Shadrach doesn't obey the command of a coup, which is his name. Meshach's life answers the question, who is like Yahweh, not who is like a coup. And the name of the Babylonian god Nabu is not Abednego. So it's sarcastically misspelled in Abednego's name. So every time you hear these 3 men, but particularly at the end, Abednego's name, it's like someone calling me, "Hey, Aaron. Hey, Aaron." Or, "Hey, what's your name? Is your name Aaron Snott instead of Aaron Scott?" Or like if you don't really like the Mandalorian, you would call it the Mandasnorian. You know, like, man, this is kind of boring. Or if you don't like the cowboys, you would call them the cowgirls, you know. So there's all kinds of things. It'd be like that. All 12 times the names of these young men are mentioned, it's intended to kind of give the original readers a little chuckle, like a little snicker in the middle of the passage. The rhythm and repetition of this chapter is structured around the king's question. I already kind of mentioned this in verse 15. So now that we've kind of basically seen the flow and structure of the passage, let's kind of dig into the text. Look at verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and breadth 6 cubits. In order to understand what's going on here, what Nebuchadnezzar is doing, we need to remember the dream. Do you remember the dream from last chapter? Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and the dream was of a large image. The image where the head was of gold, and the torso and arms was of silver, the midsection was of bronze, and the legs were of iron and clay. Well, what's going on here? Each section of the image represented the kingdoms of the earth that were to come in the future, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar, who was the head of gold. Well, if you notice what happens, what is the image made of? Entirely of gold. There's not the same image going on here. So what do you think of it? Well, it says that it's about 90 feet tall and 90 feet wide, and the image is most likely set up in a walled area. That's what the word dura means, something that is walled. It's the Akkadian word. It's most likely somewhere in the city of Babylon. I don't think the ESV translation is as helpful in this spot. But again, what's the image made of? It's made entirely of gold, and we'll come back to that. So what is the image? Is this of Nebuchadnezzar? Is it of a Babylonian god? What's the actual image? The text doesn't say. And scholars really disagree on this one. Some would say it's Nebuchadnezzar, and some would say it's a Babylonian god in the Babylonian pantheon. So what do you think? If you were to nail it down and you were to say, hey, this is what who I think it is. It's a rhetorical question. You can kind of look at it. There's no instance in biblical or extra-biblical sources where a Babylonian king is seen as a deity. So I don't think this is actually an image of Nebuchadnezzar. There are other nations that did, and all other civilizations like Egypt and China. They set their emperors or their kings up as, or their pharaohs as, gods or deities. It's not like that in Babylon. Because of the dream in the previous chapter, I think the image represents actually the nation state of Babylon that was established under Nebuchadnezzar's kingship. So it could be an image of Nebuchadnezzar representing the kingdom of Babylon. I don't think that they were intended to worship Nebuchadnezzar as a god, but to see his leadership as being supremely established by his gods who had defeated all the other gods in their nations. Remember, warfare was seen as deities fighting each other. So because every one of these nations had been defeated by Nebuchadnezzar as the instrument of the Babylonian gods, every nation, people, and language was to bow down and worship his dominion and his gods or die. In essence, he and his gods had brought into servitude all the other gods, the other gods of the known world, and when he was calling them to bow, he was calling them to acknowledge him and his gods' supremacy over all the other gods. But what do you notice about the image? We've already talked about this a little bit. It's entirely made of gold. There's not four sections. And so what's happening here? He's seeking to establish the Babylonian rule as the everlasting, indestructible kingdom that's referred to at the end of his dream. No kingdom will come after this. Babylon is the supreme kingdom, and not even the Israelite God can defeat him. So worship the king he set up and the gods who put him on the throne or die. I mean, so in a 20th century example of what's going on here is really kind of, actually the Heil Hitler of the Hitler regime, the Third Reich. So how did you know if someone was committed to the Third Reich and Hitler's leadership? You would walk up to him and say, Heil Hitler. You raised your hand and saluted your comrade. Here, you fell down and worshipped. And how did the nations respond? Look at verse 7. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard that sound, the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. But the plot thickens in verse 8. It starts getting a little bit exciting. The scene moves from the plain of Dura into the king's court. Who's there? Well, actually, if you think about it, the last verse in chapter 2 indicates that that's where Daniel was. He's kind of missing in this story, and that's where I believe Daniel's at in this. But it moves, the picture moves from the plain of Dura to the king's court. The Chaldean crybabies are the ones that are there. The tattletales of the Babylonian Empire. And what do they say? Look at verses 9 through 12. King, you've commanded everyone to bow to the image you've set up when the music begins. Those who don't get roasted. Totally roasted. Remember those Jews you appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon? The ones you appointed over us, O king? Well, they're really not giving you the attention you deserve. And you commanded. And so they don't bow to the music that you told them to bow to your image. So can you remind me, what was the thing that you said would happen to them if they don't bow? Oh, yeah, you roast them. I guess that means there's going to be a few vacant positions on your leadership team. Have you thought about me? Kind of what's going on here. I always used to picture this in my mind, like when everyone's bowing in verse 7, I used to picture this in my mind as a vast group of thousands and thousands of people encircling this big image. And I think that's true. When the music played, the mass of people bowed. Then the three young men took a bold stand as the three men who were left standing when everyone else was bowing. But do you find that here in the text? Bold, brazen, pompous. I'm standing. Y'all are sitting. Nope. Actually, it's not in the text. If you read the text carefully, you'll find that if the Chaldean crybabies hadn't tattled, the king would never have known. The three young men were not brazen and abrasive in their stance. Like every other instance in the book, these faithful men were humble yet resolute in their obedience to God. In verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar lays out an ultimatum to these men. Bow or burn. Look at verse 14. Trying to get on the right page here. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made well and good. But if you do not worship, you'll immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Again, this is the primary crisis of the chapter. Is there a God able to save his people from Nebuchadnezzar and the gods of Babylon? If you're an original reader, you have to ask that question. We hear a very similar question offered by Pharaoh in Exodus chapter 5. "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, moreover, I will not let Israel go." God loves to take arrogant pagan rulers to school and give them an education in his sovereignty over them. And he's about to do that with King Nebuchadnezzar. By this time in history, it's likely that the second or even the third invasion of Jerusalem has taken place. And some scholars actually believe that that's the main reason why Nebuchadnezzar is setting up this image. By all accounts, the God of Israel had been defeated. His temple had been pillaged. Look at verse 1 of chapter 1. And the vessels of his temple had been brought to the treasury of the gods of Babylon. Is Yahweh able to save and deliver his people who are in exile? Has Yahweh been defeated? Is Yahweh a tired, old God who is no longer able to keep his promises? Is this not the question that you and I wrestle with in our hearts every time we pray something substantial? Is God able? Does he have the power to work in my life? Does he still answer prayer? Does he even care that I'm stuck in Babylon? We've seen that Nebuchadnezzar had clearly placed his trust in God's and his own ability. Now let's see the reply of the three faithful men. Look at verses 16 through 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will still not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. You may say, what's the big deal? Why don't these Israelites just bow and get it over with? It's not as simple as that. You see, the Mosaic Covenant, way back in the book of Exodus, in that covenant, God had cut a covenant with Israel and established 10 stipulations to that covenant. 10 commandments. The first three dealt with the exclusive worship of Yahweh for his people. If Israel keeps the covenant and remains faithful to God in worship through those 10 commandments, then they will be blessed. But if they rebel and neglect the commands, then they will be carried off to another land. You can read about that in Deuteronomy chapter 28 and chapter 30. Through chapter 30, which is written about 800 years before Daniel's written. So all three of the first commandments are at stake here for these three men. They were not to worship any other gods. They were not to bow down before or serve any graven images. And number three, these are the first three commands. They were not to take the name of the Lord their God in vain. And that third command has almost nothing to do with their language or their speech, but everything to do with living in a way that assumes that God is a weighty, substantial God. He is able. Every single one of those first three commands is at stake here. Look at their response. O King Nebuchadnezzar, they're respectful. They emphasize the fear of God. We have no need to answer you on this. We stand before a greater king. They acknowledge the king's command. If it be so. So in other words, hey, what you've commanded, we'll take the punishment, but we're going to follow our God. They point to their service and obedience to their own God, Yahweh, our God whom we serve. Then they answer his question. The question, what God is able to deliver you out of my hand? And they answer it with this. Our God is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. Notice that they emphasize his ability to deliver them from the furnace, but they also emphasize that it is sure and unquestionably that he's going to deliver them from Nebuchadnezzar's hands. He'll deliver us from your hand, O king. But even if he doesn't, they're referencing that even if God doesn't rescue them from his hand, they will not disobey their God's command. What a resolute answer. Their answer has nothing to do with God's inability. They're not questioning God's inability, but it has everything to do with God's sovereignty, his kingship. If God, the king, chooses for us to die, praise be to the king. Their answer places God firmly on the throne over King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar couldn't have their hearts. That belonged to the King of Heaven. Even if God chooses to let us die, we will still not serve your gods or worship the image you've set up. This is a practical rubber meets the road way of saying, Lord, your will be done. Like Jesus says in the garden. They're saying that I will obey and serve and worship the God of heaven alone, even if it means that I die at the end of it all. What a stark contrast to Nebuchadnezzar and his view of his gods. As we saw last week, Nebuchadnezzar viewed the God of Israel as kind of like a utilitarian tool to enhance his own abilities. And to kind of, he viewed him as, and all the gods as kind of like their his self-preservation and self-glorification tool. I'll serve whatever God gets me what I want. And the three faithful young men saw God as all-wise and all-worthy of worship and obedience, even at the cost of their own lives. His glory was worth more than their lives. This strikes a stark contrast with how our world views religion. If you're struggling with depression, find a religion that will give you self-help. If you're struggling with drugs, replace your drugs with a religion. But if you're doing fine, you don't really need religion because religion is a crutch for the weak. If religion can help you get off a bad spot, then use that religion to get you there. That's how Nebuchadnezzar saw religion. But God is not interested in being a pill, your pill to a better life. That's why Jesus says in Luke 9:23, if anyone wants to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life would lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his own soul? God's not a six-step plan for a better life. In fact, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German martyr during Hitler's regime and occupation in Germany, says, when Jesus calls a man, he bids him come and die. And actually this week, this last week was a celebrate, was it was marked the anniversary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's death under Hitler's occupation. Don't get me wrong, this is not a weightless death, but a death that says there's something of greater value than my life. God and his unmatched glory is worthy of our lives, and these young men understood that. Look back at verse 19. Verse 19 says, then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He's furious. He orders the furnace to be heated up seven times what it normally is heated up. And really, that's just a euphemism for saying, get it as hot as it can go. I want it completely as hot as it can be. Then they're thrown into the burning fiery furnace. It's funny that the writer even details that Nebuchadnezzar says, I want you to bind them hand and foot. I even want you to bind their hats. If you look at the text, that detail. I want you to tie their hats down. Then they're thrown into the burning fiery furnace. But the furnace is so hot that the best men in Nebuchadnezzar's army, his mighty men, his servants, die throwing them into the fire because it's so hot. And the reader can expect to end the story right here, right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have been executed. Write the next chapter. But it doesn't. Look at verse 24. Then Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, was astonished and rose up in haste. You can almost see Nebuchadnezzar fuming as he watches the men thrown into the fire, looking expectantly for them to die. He doesn't care that his most mighty men have just died, been burned alive as they've thrown Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the fire. They can serve as offerings and sacrifices to my greatness. Nebuchadnezzar's brutality is observable with the fact that he has an opening in his kiln designed specifically to watch people burn alive. Isn't that gross? But his reaction here is one of astonishment and shock, as should be us as readers. What? These guys are not burning up? Let's read. Then came, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. So who is this person who's walking around with them? He says, did we not cast three men bound up in the fire? Yup. Well, then why do I see four men walking around unbound in the middle of my kiln, my execution spot? And the fourth one looks like the son of the gods. Actually, there's a heavy debate on who that person is in the kiln or in the fire with them. Some people will say that this is the angel of the Lord. Others will say that this is a Christophany, which is basically an Old Testament pre-incarnate image of Christ in the Old Testament. Both of those are compelling views, and I think this is compelling because of the message of the whole book, the message that Christ, the King of heaven, is coming to establish his throne. I think it's compelling, but I don't land at either one of those spots as it's just being the angel of the Lord or a pre-incarnate Christology, Christophany. I don't land in either one of those spots because I don't think that's what the text is saying. I don't think the question wants us to ask who this is, because I think that's implied in the text. It's clear that God is with his people. Rather, I think the primary question is, why is he here? Do you remember the king's dream team response back in chapter 2? Their response to the king's demands in chapter 2. Look back at chapter 2, verse 11. Chapter 2, verse 11. I'll read it out loud. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods. Listen to this last phrase. Whose dwelling is not with flesh. To every Israelite reading this account, sparks will begin to go off as soon as you begin to mention smoke and fire in connection with the presence of God with his people. What comes to mind when you mention smoke, fire, and God's presence with God's people? The Exodus. God's presence with his people was made perfectly clear with the pillar of fire and the smoke in the wilderness. The pillar of fire at night and the pillar of smoke during the day. Then again at the dedication of the temple and the tabernacle. And in Isaiah's vision in Isaiah chapter 6. When God's presence is with his people and you have fire and smoke at the same spot. Anybody reading this, if you're a Jew, you're going to go, man, God is keeping his promises. He's rescuing his people just like he did in Exodus. So God's presence with God's people is made evidence in the fire and the smoke. When these men are thrown into the burning fiery furnace for their unwavering worship of Yahweh, the readers are reminded that God's presence is with those who trust in him and worship him alone. In this instance, God is reminding his people that though their worship may result in them being roasted in the fire, he is with them. Though they're exiles in Babylon, God will rescue those who trust in him. These young men had wholeheartedly trusted in the God of Israel who dwells with his people. And the question is this: can God dwell with his people in exile? Yes! Look, there he is! The king is with his people. Can the Garden of Eden be found in the fires of Babylon? Yes! God dwells with those who trust in him, and he walks with them in the flames. Christian, does God dwell with his people in their afflictions? In the fire? This story should shift your attention off your affliction. Shift your eyes off your affliction and place them firmly on Emmanuel, God with us, who's with us in our affliction, who's with us and for us in the flames. The author of Hebrews reminds us in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, to fix our eyes on our great high priest. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. So then, let us then come with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Are you afflicted with sorrow, pain, and discouragement? Peter refers to this in his epistle as fiery trials. Then go confidently before the throne of grace, looking to our advocate, our great high priest, who has suffered affliction with us. And you'll find mercy and grace to help in time of need. Mom, does Jesus dwell with you in your time as your little children are driving you nuts? Yes. Look to him. Christian, does Jesus dwell with you when your finances don't add up? Yes. Look to him and trust him. Christian, does God go with you as you carry the gospel to your neighbors and coworkers? Yes. He promises to go with you in the Great Commission. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. All through Jesus' life, we find examples of him dwelling with us in our affliction, sorrow, and fear. I'm reminded of Mark 4, when the disciples were in a storm in the middle of the night. The waves were spilling into the boat, and on the verge of sinking, the boat was on the verge of sinking, when one of the disciples cried out, "Jesus, do you not care that we are dying?" I love the little detail in Mark's gospel where he actually says Jesus was was asleep in the back of the boat and he was sleeping on a pillow. Like that little detail. He's resting in the back of the boat on a pillow. Jesus stands up and calmly commands a storm, "Peace, be still." Friend, if you're a Christian, remember that the master of the storm is in the boat with you. He's in the fire with you. We can rest in him in the storm because he is with us. Trust in Jesus. There's no one who can rescue like the Most High God who can rescue. No one can rescue like the Most High God can rescue. Look back at verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come near." What happens here? Once again, Nebuchadnezzar is acknowledging the superiority of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. He is the God above all other gods. The leadership, the Chaldeans, the wise men, all see, smell, and feel the superiority of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God by looking and observing. Not the fire did not singe their hair, nor is there any smell of fire on them. Verses 28 through 30. Nebuchadnezzar makes a proclamation. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid to ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So what's the focus of Nebuchadnezzar's proclamation? Is it on the boldness and courage of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? No, it's on the unmatched ability of their God, the Most High God, to save. There is no God who can save like our God. Friend, this theme carries all the way through to the end of Scripture, and it meets you right here in this room tonight. There is no one who can save like the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In Paul's letter to the Romans, we find this same argument. If you want to peek over there, you can. In Romans chapter 5. In Romans chapter 5, Paul is finishing up an argument that he's carried through chapters 1 through 3. And he starts in chapters 1 through 3 and he says, hey, humanity is sinful. Pagans who are completely rejecting God's authority, they're sinful. In chapters 2 through 3, those who are self-righteous, Jewish, pious people that worship him in the front but have hearts full of cankerous sores, who are actually not worshiping him with their lives. That's chapters 2 through 3. And you get to chapter 4, what's the solution? Faith in our sovereign God. But more specifically, you get to chapter 5 and you find that, therefore, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Skip down to verse number 6. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. The picture here is of someone who is standing before a judgment seat, and the judge pronounces justice on them. But it's actually someone stands up and says, hey, that guy's actually a good person, so I'll stand up for them. This is verse 7. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person. Hey, that's a righteous person over there. I'm going to stand up for that person. I'll die. That's a rare occasion for that to happen. And perhaps for a good person, some would even dare to die. Or even a good person. Say, not just a completely righteous, but maybe like kind of a good person. But what does Paul say here in verse 8? But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, we weren't righteous. We didn't fall into the category of a good person. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, much more shall we be, here's that word again, that you find in Daniel, made safe, delivered, made safe by him from the wrath of God. There really is no one who can save like our God can save. If you question that, look at the cross. Our God came, he came in the form of he was born as a child from the Virgin Mary, incarnate. God incarnate, and offered himself as a sacrifice. He lived a perfect life and offered himself as a sacrifice for sinful people like us. People who he even says on the cross, "Father, forgive these people, for they don't know what they're doing." The scandal of the cross is that you and I don't deserve God's salvation. But yet, he saves like no other can save. Turn to him. Trust in him. There is no God who can save like our God can save. Let's pray.